This is Judaism Unbound, episode 129, Women of the Wall. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And as we get close to the conclusion of this series, looking at the future of the relationship between Israel and American Jews, we're excited to talk to some folks on the other side of the pond who are working for progressive change in Israel. Leslie Sachs is the executive director of Women of the Wall, a group of Jewish women from Israel and around the world who strive to achieve the right to wear prayer shawls, pray, and read from the Torah collectively and out loud at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. And Susan Silverman is a board member of Women of the Wall and also an activist working to stand up for the rights of asylum seekers from Africa who have come to Israel and are in danger of being deported. Before coming to Women of the Wall, Leslie Sachs served as executive director of the Israel Religious Action Center, vice president of the World Union for Progressive Judaism, and founding director of Project Kesher Israel. Susan Silverman has rabbinical ordination from the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. With her husband Yosef Abramowitz, she is the author of the best-selling book Jewish Family and Life, Traditions, Holidays, and Values for Today's Parents and Children. And more recently, she is the author of Casting Lots, Creating a Family in a Beautiful, Broken World. Her rabbinic work includes activism on behalf of asylum seekers in Israel, advocating for liberal Judaism, and promoting adoption. She is the founder of Kamocha, a Jewish response to refugees, serves on the International Council of the New Israel Fund, and is the founding director of Second Nurture, Every Child Deserves a Family and a Community. Leslie Sachs, Susan Silverman, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you so much.
So, Leslie, I think that it would be great to start off with a little bit of an understanding for our listeners who haven't been familiar with the work of Women of the Wall to know a little bit more about sort of what is the context that led to its being created and what is it all about?
We're marking 30 years next year, and we're not saying celebrating because it's not a celebration. It's not a celebration to have to fight for something so basic that should have been solved within 10 minutes. And what we're fighting for is what we call the four T's. We want to pray in the women's section of the Western Wall. Firstly is out loud. That's the tefillah, to pray out loud. They don't want to hear women's voices. The second one is with the tefillin. More and more women, and it's very, very interesting that this is something that's changed over the years. More and more women have taken upon themselves the laying of tefillin. The third is the talit. And the fourth is the Torah scroll. And that is what we've been fighting for. But because the Western Wall is the Mecca of the Jewish people, it is so central to all of us. It has become not only a very central battle, but also in so many ways a symbol of the fight, both for gender equality, of course, and for religious pluralism in Israel. So what Women of the Wall do, we come on the high holidays and once a month at the beginning of the month, which is traditionally has always been a time when women have prayed together. And we come to the women's section and have a prayer service, sometimes with more disturbance and sometimes with less disturbance. We've been to court, we've been in negotiations with the government. And as a result of our battle in 2016, January 2016, the government of Israel voted to create a pluralistic plaza in an area that had not really been used for prayer. And we were in negotiations for 3 years. And it's important to talk about these negotiations in the context of Israeli and diaspora Jews, in that we were all at the negotiating table together. So this was a joint decision. And then the government voted to implement this agreement that was reached. And then the Prime Minister reneged on it. So this is really, in a nutshell, the battle of Women of the Wall.
Just think about this for a second. In Israel, brags to be a progressive liberal democracy, there are different civil laws for men as for women. Think about that. The insanity of that. How the whole country is not going crazy, I do not understand. How world Jewry is not losing their minds over this. There are different civil laws for men as for women.
So let's get into that question, because I think that it would be interesting to understand a little bit of the history of this, because I have a sense that while it's true that I think that a lot of Israelis who look at this and sort of in a vacuum say, yeah, it's crazy, you know, but they say it, I think, in a little bit more of a like dismissive tone than you just did, Susan. You know, they just say, that's crazy, whatever, you know, but who cares about the Western Wall, you know? And the question is, in terms of, you know, what's going on, I mean, I guess, how did the ultra-Orthodox point of view come to dominate the way that the Western Wall is dealt with, you know, because it seems that really the issue is that once upon a time, and I'm not sure exactly when, the authority was ceded to a particular group of ultra-Orthodox Jews, and nobody in Israel seems to care all that much to fight them, and it sort of seems like it's a small group of people in Israel, and then it's like the weight of Jews outside of Israel, but that seems to be insufficient to carry the day. I was just wondering if you could give us a sense of how it happened and then kind of what the difference in attitude between Israelis and non-Israelis seems to be on this issue.
The Western Wall has changed. When I was a child in 1967 and we went there, I grew up in Israel from a very young age. The partition between the men and the women's side was knee-high. And everything felt different and looked different. And it happened gradually over the years because this ultra-Orthodox rabbi started turning the Western Wall to look more and more like his synagogue. And in a way, it's understandable. And the problem was we were not on guard. People just said, okay, so it's happening. So, you know, maybe that's the Judaism in the synagogue I don't go to. That's the real Judaism. And it was only when this practice started infringing on women's rights in the most basic way, as Susan said, not wanting to hear our voice, silencing us, physically silencing us, that people started waking up and saying, one moment, what's happening here?
I'd love to poke a little bit more at something you briefly mentioned around this idea of sort of real Judaism, that, oh, sure, there may be all sorts of different pluralized kinds of Judaisms that exist, but it seems like in people's minds, even those who aren't practicing, who aren't going to synagogue, you alluded to the folk, oh, that's the synagogue I don't go to. It seems like there's this perception that, sure, there's many different kinds of Judaisms, many in which women are equal, many in which women are not. But this, the most authentic or the most real Judaism in many people's eyes seems to be ultra-Orthodox Judaism. And I guess, for me, I look at that and it's just such a tragedy because, you know, I live and participate in Judaisms that aren't that. But it seems like that's part of what perpetuates this system, is that people look at the Western Wall and they say, oh, that's the preeminent Jewish site. It should sort of be the real thing there. And even if I don't like it, even if it's not how I do Judaism, like I get why it would be under the control of an ultra-Orthodox set of people. So I'd love to hear, how do you respond to those folks?
We are a Sinaitic people, right? We all stood at Sinai together and received the word of God, and each one individually and as a nation. It's absurd to think that there's one small slice of Judaism that is truth, right? In fact, I would argue that if you say that, like, that the small definition of God's will is truth, then that is a form of idolatry, because idolatry is taking an unknowable whole, which is God, and condensing it, distilling it down to something small and knowable. Now, whether that's something you hold in your hand or whether it's something you hold in your mind, it doesn't much matter. Right. The question is, are we distilling God down to something that we can know? And that's what the ultra-Orthodox are saying. They're saying that they absolutely know a truth, and that the truth about God, and I would argue that's idolatry. A. And it's anti-democratic. I mean, in theory, Israel is a democracy. And you can't have different laws for men and for women. Even the language that we use is problematic, right? We use the language of, like, they don't want to hear our voices. Excuse me, Leslie, but just it's a great example of, like, who's they and who's us? And why are they the arbiters of legitimacy? Whether they are pharaohs who are evil or pharaohs who are benevolent, it doesn't much matter. They're still pharaohs. And as soon as we have a model of one sort of Judaism having a greater sense of it than others, or having some truth that others don't have, we're in a really dangerous territory. Now, what people would say is, whoa, on the margins, we're going to get all kinds of messy things. Like, Jews for Jesus is like the favorite thing of people to bring up. Oh, what about Jews for Jesus? You know, we're going to, and I'm thinking, yeah, we're going to have messy edges. And in fact, we do have messy edges. We already have messy edges. That's what the nature of being Jewish is, la soka b'divrei Torah. Like, we're engaging in these words. We're dealing with the messiness of it all. You know, and to have sort of one image in lockstep is anti-Jewish and it's anti-democratic.
I want to talk about another aspect of that. I of course, agree 100% with everything that Susan's saying, but I need to put in the political aspect here. When we talk about religion in Israel, in this case, ultra-Orthodoxy, we're talking politics, we're talking money, we're talking fighting to keep that power. And even at the Western Wall, when you think about it, whoever controls the Western Wall is firstly controlling a lot of money. The Kotel Heritage Foundation, which runs the Western Wall, has a budget of about $20 million a year, taxpayers' money. Now, nobody gives that up. Not to talk about the fact that any dignitary who comes to Israel comes to the Western Wall, whether it's the President of the United States or Leonardo DiCaprio or Madonna, anyone, they come, the Pope, they come. And so nobody wants to give up that power that they have managed to retain and enlarge over the years. Nobody will give it up, certainly not to a group of women who, or it has turned more than just women of the wall, liberal Jews, God forsake. I do want to mention here something that I should have mentioned before, and that is that we are, our group, Women of the Wall, are also Orthodox women, modern Orthodox women. And that goes to say that what we are doing in the women's section is within the boundaries of the halakha, the Jewish law. But when you're mixing politics with religion, then that is exactly what comes out. And then you need to ask yourself, where is our democracy getting lost? Where is it getting lost? How is it getting lost?
You know, and for example, our son, who is in combat in the IDF, is not considered Jewish by the Rabbanut.
The Israeli Rabbinate.
The fucking Rabbanut, who takes control over the questions of who is a Jew and who isn't a Jew, who don't fucking serve in the army, will say that my son, who stands on that goddamn Gaza border with a gun in his hands and kites bursting around him, would not be considered Jewish in their minds. And the reason he is there is because he is a Jewish Israeli who is a Zionist and does his duty. And yet, he can't get married in this country. So we have five kids. Two of our kids, as I say, we produce girls and import boys. So our two boys are from Ethiopia. Our girls are bio. And they had beautiful conversions with a beautiful Beit Din of three women and a mikvah attendant of a male rabbi, and became Jewish there. And then we made Aliyah. And that's not acknowledged by this rabbinate, who, by the way, and I have asked Haredi people, like, how would you feel if Reform Judaism was the civil law? They said, chas v'chalila, that would be terrible. I said, okay, then don't you believe that what is hateful to you, do not do to another? Like, that is something we can all, that's a sentiment we can all agree on as Jews, right? I want to organize liberal rabbis who have done weddings here, because we could be in prison for 2 years in theory. And I want us to turn ourselves in. I want us to, like, hundreds of us show up and turn ourselves in and say, you know what? Either change the law or arrest us and process us right now.
You it's haven't been arrested enough for us, for women of the world. You need another cause to be arrested for.
You know, I've been bored.
I think that this also raises a really important question about what to do when any government, but in this case, the government of Israel, is not doing what you believe very firmly it ought to be doing in order to live up to its own ideals. Because I think that that is one of the topics that really has animated a lot of the folks here in America who have been protesting and pressuring in one way or another and have gotten tremendous pushback from the American Jewish establishment to say that's not the right way to do it. And I think that it would be interesting to sort of understand from you how you have chosen the approaches that you've chosen, including forms of civil disobedience. And, you know, even what you said, Susan, I mean, the willingness to be arrested, which is a classic tool of civil disobedience, but yet quite a significant step, and one that, you know, has not been looked upon very kindly here in America when there have been protesters in front of Jewish organizations that have, you know, engaged in similar tactics. And I guess I'm interested in understanding from you, you know, what's your analysis of how to approach some of these questions in a situation where it seems, right, that it's not that a majority supports what the government is doing. In fact, a majority, if you ask them in a poll, probably would say that they oppose it. But perhaps it's not high enough on their priority list or something such that this small minority is able to get the power to continue to do things the way they've been doing it. And so what is your goal in the various things that you're doing? Is it to bring attention and to try to get that silent majority to not be silent? Or is it just to recognize that politics is ultimately between two active minorities and you're just trying to establish the alternative active minority? Or how do you think about the strategy of addressing something like this?
Personally, I might have different goals than the official goals of Women of the Wall. And of course, as a member of Women of the Wall board, I am part of a consensus, right? So I want to destroy the Rabbanut. We need to be rid of them. They're a negative force on society. They're oppressive. They are anti-democratic. And I believe that they are anti-Jewish. You talk about the fear of, like, an expanded Judaism. Here we have a people who say that there are a few people who are closer to God who can interpret God for the rest of us. I think that's really problematic as Jews. To my mind, it's a very problematic Judaism. And A, it's problematic because of being also civil law. And B, it's a problematic theology and practice for me. It doesn't mean that I want to make them illegal the way they want to make me illegal, right? I don't. I want freedom. I want to be able to have a Judaism that's like in a million different flowers in this country.
I want to maybe digress one moment. Both Susan and I give a lot of presentations in North America. We travel a lot, we speak a lot, and the hardest is always at the universities, when I speak at the Hillels and the universities. And the younger generation say, I don't give a damn anymore, you know, and that's a terrible thing. But yet they did come to hear us, to hear me in this case, and they want to know more about it, and they engaged on Facebook. So there is that caring there, which we need to try and retain. And that is, I think, the hardest thing, to keep it, but still invite them to be part of the change and to fight for the change. And I'm sure that Susan feels it in all the different areas that she's fighting for change here when she talks to non-Israelis.
Jews outside of Israel have an absolute right and obligation to participate and to be active as long as they agree with me. The ones who don't agree with me, you can just shut up.
Yep, that's strong policy, I think. So I want to push a little bit at what you said about college campuses, not from disagreement, but because I think it's so important. And I want to go into the I don't give a damn world for a second, because I think that is a big world and it's a growing world among younger American Jews with respect maybe to Israel with large, but maybe specifically with respect to the questions that are brought up by Women of the Wall. And I wanna segment. I think there's two I don't give a damns that I hear frequently among young American Jews, specifically with questions of the Kotel, of prayer at the wall. One, I don't give a damn. For listeners, I'm like motioning with my hand in all sorts of funny directions to draw pictures of the two. One, I don't give a damn is from people who say, well, this whole wall thing, it kind of feels like an idol. It kind of feels strange to me that this paradigmatic experience of going to Israel involves like standing at a wall, and it feels like strange to them. I hear that more and more from people that it almost feels idolatrous in a strange way to treat the wall as like a god. And I'm not, once again, I'm not endorsing either of these I don't give a damns. I'm just saying that I hear them sometimes. The other I don't give a damn comes from folks who are actually deeply involved as activists who engage with American Jewish institutions about Israel and specifically about Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. And what they find is that issues of religious pluralism are brought up as, we are doing this, but by institutions, we are working on this as a way to sort of deflect from not working on issues of the occupation and of the rights of Palestinians. And so I think people are wrong to respond to that with, oh, I'm not going to care about that issue. I think that's not the way to respond. But that's what I often hear as a critique, which is that this is sort of used as a way to deflect from other issues that they're less comfortable in the reform or conservative worlds confronting. So I guess I'd love to hear from your perspective why it's so important for those people not to not give a damn, to give a damn, and participate in this issue. And maybe there's questions of how this relates to other broader questions in Israel-Palestine that they care about. Just, I'd love to hear from both of you on that front.
So I really do not buy into this. Like, why are you focusing on the wall, or why are you focusing on asylum seekers when, you know, what's happening with the Palestinians? And I feel like what we're doing is good work in the world. So you do something about the balance. Like, I agree it's really important. And many of the people in my circle, that's their main thing in their worlds. But we all do what we're sort of called to do, right? So call on like hedge fund managers to do something about Palestinians. Like, they're not working for anyone else. You know, like, why, you know, sort of like my day job is an adoption world, and people will often say like, well, why would you promote adoption internationally when the money that it costs to adopt internationally could go to a whole orphanage? I'm like, why do you want to, you know, take from adoption to pay for orphanages? Take from like all the waste in the world to pay for orphanage. Like, why are you pitting these things against each other? And that's how I feel about this. Like, why are you pitting like women's rights? Why are you pitting asylum seekers against Palestinian rights? Like, why?
When I talk on the campuses, and it's really interesting, in one of my most recent trips, I went to three universities. And the first thing that happened in each one of them is that the people, the youngsters who greeted me from Hillel and took me around, they showed me very proudly, in all three of them, the new bathrooms, which are now gender neutral. Because that is important to them, that touches on their everyday life. They care about it. It's in a way something that defines their generation. And then I have to start talking to them about religious pluralism in Israel and Women of the Wall. And they get very excited, because gender equality is still really, really important. We've got to remember that this battle is first and foremost, even before anything else, a gender battle. It's a group of men who are running the Western Wall, who are holding the money, who are making decisions, and especially to keep the women quiet and in check. So this does speak to them in a way. And one of the things that, again, I talk to them about, and I feel, is why should we care about Israel? And why should we care, as far as I'm concerned, is because both my parents, as youngsters, were born in Germany, both of them in Berlin. And both the families got out at the last minute. I'm talking about October 39 to South Africa. And my mother was on the last boat that ever entered South Africa. Now, South Africa didn't really want Jews so much, but they wanted more white people. But had South Africa not opened their gates, I certainly wouldn't be here, and millions of others wouldn't either. And we need Israel. We need to have a state of our own, and we need to be part of the defining of that state. What are the values? Are we talking about ultra-Orthodox values, or are we talking about democracy?
As Leslie describes the story of South Africa almost being accidentally open to Jews because they were white before the Holocaust, to at least a few Jews, that I think a subject that a lot of American Jews that know about it are having a hard time wrapping their minds around is what's going on in Israel today in terms of African refugees who are fleeing from war and from famine, and just as we did. And the country that we've established to be a refuge for ourselves doesn't seem to be open to these refugees in the way that we have been saying for 70 years that we demand that the world had been open to us. And you've been an activist about this, and I'm really interested in your reflections on sort of what's going on. There was also a story there with a deal and then a reneging. And how do you see this, and kind of, I suppose at a deep level, the question is, you know, if Israel is not a place that is an example for the world about how to take in refugees, then in a way, what's the point?
I completely agree with you. Like, the point of a Jewish state is not that we have halakha as civil law run by a bunch of men. The point is that we live our Jewish values, that it's the place in which we as Jews can be our conceivable best. And that's what I live by. And the question about asylum seekers is really a question of what it means to be a Jewish state. And I don't want Israel to ask, how little can we get away with? We have 38,000 people here who have come to us in the most desperate of circumstances, from Darfur, from Eritrea, which is essentially the North Korea of Africa. Terrified. They have come through harrowing, harrowing experiences in order to get here, through Egypt, through Sinai. And when they end up having to leave Israel, they are back on the refugee trail. They are on auction blocks in Libya. They are in refugee camps at risk of their lives. We are putting their lives at risk, and we know it. And it is up to us to use our Jewish values and our capacity to make worldwide change, and we can do that. So we have the opportunity here to create Startup Nation University for refugees, where we train, for example, Eritreans in cutting-edge technologies of Israel. And then we can export that curriculum worldwide to the 1.5 million Eritreans who live around the world, who are expats, that when it's safe to go back to Eritrea, you can have hundreds of thousands of people trained in Israeli technologies. Now, that's changing the world. That's being a light unto the nations, not haggling over how few can we keep here. Let's think big. Let's be God's partners in recreating the world, in tikkun olam, and making the world a better place, as opposed to thinking Rosh Katan in these little tiny ways and defining Judaism as some like perfect, excuse me for mixing metaphors, like Platonic ideal of Shabbat. I'm not interested in the minutiae of halakha or doing some perfect Shabbat or some perfect kashrut. I'm interested in Shabbat and keeping kosher and the Jewish rituals and rhythms of life and being building blocks for a just and a compassionate society and for being a light unto the nations. And that's what we can do with the asylum seekers who are here. They are a gift to us. It's a gift that these people who were forced to run from their homes came to us. And it's in our hands.
I think that a lot of American Jews, in particular young ones, are experiencing in a way something I think that Leslie's description was really important, to say that, look, in our lives in America, we're very concerned about gender equality and about transgender equality and all kinds of things like that. And so what we're looking for from Israel is to be a light unto the nations, right? To be a place whose values mirror our values. And that's not what they're seeing. And I think as a result, a lot of them are disengaging, but you're doing the opposite of disengaging. You're fully engaged. What do you hope that the relationship of American Jews in Israel will be in light of the realities of Israel on some of the things that really touch American Jews the most closely, such as that their form of practicing Judaism isn't really what's going on there, that a lot of the Jewish values like Tikkun Olam that American Jews talk about all the time are some of the ones that are at greatest threat in Israel. And how do we sort of open up a relationship with Israel where folks can be honest about the realities and yet don't have to make the conclusion to say, I am just disengaging completely?
We have amazing people in Israel and we have fucking assholes in Israel. We have the whole range of humanity in Israel. And guess what? There's nothing perfect about us. We just have a struggle. And the more people who are liberal and progressive engage in that struggle, the more powerful liberal values will be. The more people who are more narrow-minded and want to oppress others, the more powerful that's going to be. And there's nothing magic here. It's just being in the struggle and continuing it as best we can and convincing other people, not forcing them, but using the power of our ideas to engage other people in this and to move us forward. And I like doing it in Israel because I do feel like this power of some sort of, I don't know if this is the right phrase, but like turnkey here, that there's something that if we can shift it here, I feel like it does have some sort of impact. And I want to be part of that. And I want to have an impact in this way, but there's just no magic. And if people are going to be disillusioned because we have shitheads in our government, then be disillusioned. But that's your choice. The other option is to get involved and get active and make it happen. Up to you. Like it's, and I really, honestly, people don't have to be engaged in Israel to be legitimate in some way. You don't have to be. Be engaged in whatever you want to be engaged in that's going to move things forward. But don't think that there's some sort of magic or that like, that Jews started at some high level and we just blew it. We didn't.
I want to talk about something that's true, both about the issue of the asylum seekers, the refugees, and women of the wall. There are those in the government who are interested and unfortunately have succeeded in many ways of turning issues which have nothing to do with right and left into issues that are labeled right-wing and left-wing. And there's an attempt all the time, for instance, with women of the wall to say, you're left-wing, which is not true. We are women who vote for different parties, but we all believe in religious freedom and gender equality. And when the government goes along with it, we're happy. And when they're not, we'll fight them. This has nothing to do with left and right.
So I have a question. I mean, this is the optimist question, since we've all shared in different ways the desire we have for optimism and occasionally the optimism we really feel. But hypothetical situation, all four T's that you mentioned before, Women of the Wall wins and there is a thriving prayer service led by and for women at the Western Wall on Rosh Chodesh at the first of the month and whenever other moments are desired. So like, let's like check that has been achieved for the world and justice is a little bit closer. That arc has bent a little bit closer towards justice. Given that what you and what Susan have said and what I think many of us are gleaning, that this fight is part of many broader issues and fights in Israel related to religious pluralism, related to the Rabbanut, related to all sorts of questions of just equality and justice. What would be next? What is this tied up with where if this was successfully achieved, we could then move on to that next front of the fight towards a fuller, brighter, more just Israel along the axes of religious pluralism and otherwise?
I need to say a few words about the egalitarian section, because that would be probably and will be probably the solution. It won't probably be accepting us without violence in the women's section with the 40s. And why am I saying that? Because when the egalitarian section is built and hopefully, and what we're fighting for at the moment is to make sure that we'll be part of the body that runs it. Because if we are not the part of the group that is that administer, that are running this egalitarian section, then very soon it's going to look exactly like the Northern Plaza. It's going to change. So let's say that happens the way that we want. That, and one of the reasons that the ultra-Orthodox are fighting this so vehemently is because it is recognizing the fact that there is more than one way to be Jewish, and allowing those different the different streams to pray in a different way than the way that the chief rabbinate wants to pray at the Western Wall. Acknowledging this fact at the wall is a huge step in acknowledging different ways of getting married and divorce in Israel, burial, conversion, all these things that we are fighting for, not we as women of the wall, but we as people who believe that Israel should recognize the myriad of Jewish practices and not only ultra-Orthodoxy. And again, I have to remind us that this is a political battle. We're talking about money, we're talking about status. And in a political battle, at a certain point, you can win. So many battles that we thought that would never happen, that could never happen, have happened. So there is place to be an optimist. I mean, the fact that we have a country of our own is already a miracle. That who would have believed it at once? So yes, things will change because young Israelis will not agree to have their life dictated by the chief rabbinate from cradle to grave. Svia Valdan, Peres's daughter, at his funeral, which was, I was on every media in Israel and in the world, she did something that made a huge change and a difference. She said the Kaddish with her two brothers. And not only did she say the Kaddish, but at the end of the Kaddish, we say, Oseh shalom b'mromav, Yehu yaseh shalom aleinu v'al kol Yisrael. And she added, he will make peace on all Israel and on all the world or the universe. And this was huge in Israel because this is something that the Reform movement does, and I think the Conservative movement as well. And she goes to a Reform shul, and suddenly everybody was talking about it and how right it is to add that at the end of the Kaddish, and the fact that it was a woman saying a Kaddish. So more and more women do choose to say Kaddish, especially if they have no brothers. When my mother passed away 3 years ago, I was adamant, and the rabbi said, oh, you can say Kaddish, but only if a man says it with you. And of course, I didn't accept that. So things do change, not as fast as we want, not as easily as we want it to change, but they do.
So just as one final question before we go, Leslie, is there anything that you want to leave our listeners with in terms of the relationship between American Jews and Israel and Women of the Wall and the future and any other topics that you want to highlight before we go?
For many, many years, we would believe in the saying that Kimitzion Tetzé Torah, the Torah, the knowledge comes out of Zion. And I think that we have learned so much. I'm talking about activists in Israel, have learned so much from Jewish activists in North America. Pluralism, this is something that it's an import in so many ways. I always feel that this is a two-way road. This is not about Israel giving and diaspora Jews taking, or the other way around. No, it's a family. And in a family, Sometimes you give, sometimes you get, you learn, you teach, you give love, you get love, as long as that family remains. And even in a family, sometimes you disagree, and that's fine. You still love each other. You still care. And you rebel sometimes, but it's still there. So keeping that feeling of family, that relationship going, that is what we need to aspire for. And it's fine to be cross, and it's fine to fight. And I really, really hope that the government of Israel gets wise in this area and stops alienating Jews who don't think the way they do. So, you know, that is my hope, my strongest hope.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. We're so pleased to have had you on. This has been great.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I've enjoyed it so much. My hero, Leslie Sachs, you guys are amazing. I'm so excited to really tune into your podcast in general from now on. Thank you.
Thank you very much for choosing this topic, choosing to talk about both Women of the Wall and the different aspects of being an activist, both in Israel and from North America. I think it's very, very important. So thank you.
And we have one more thank you to close out the episode, of course, and that's going out to all of you listening. Thanks so much for tuning in. And we want to close out the episode, as we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to Twitter at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. We also want to plug our Elul Unbound initiative that is creeping up super close. Make sure to go to our website, judaismunbound.com, and check out our Elul resources. Sign up for our daily email. And last but not least, we always hope that you can shoot us a little bit of a monetary donation, which you can do at judaismunbound.com/donate, either on a monthly recurring basis or a one-time gift. So thanks so much for listening. We hope that you will be in touch with us. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.